Anthropic Cosmological Principle is a fascinating book. It's not written by a Christian. It's a secular book, 670 pages long. What Anthropic Cosmological Principle talks about is the idea that the universe is fit for man, meaning that if we had a universe that was even slightly different from the way it is, it would be impossible to support life. That's the basic thesis of the Anthropic Cosmological Principle. I'll be talking a little bit more about it in just a few minutes. Another book I have here, this may be, might be in my bibliography, I'm not sure, Ernst Mayr, The Growth of Biological Thought. Ernst Mayr is an evolutionary biologist, one of the prominent ones. His heyday was in the 30s to the late 70s. He's still around, but that was when his hallmark was made. I may or may not also mention an article in this magazine, The World and I. The article is by Henry Morgenthau, well, it's actually about Henry Morgenthau, who is a physicist at Yale, talking about the religious dimensions of modern physics. I may or may not get into that. If I don't, you can bug me afterwards. I'd like to talk a little bit about, before I get into the main topic of this morning's discussion, a little bit about the Anthropic principle. You know, you've heard the story that we're on, in the age of the Enlightenment, all the notions that man was the center of the universe were kind of came crashing down around their ears. With the Enlightenment, we discovered that man is, let's put it this way, sort of the Earth. The Earth is kind of an insignificant planet around an average-sized star at a nondescript location in a mediocre galaxy, one of billions and billions of such galaxies. And so what is man that thou art mindful of him? I think that was written by one of the real critics in the world. That's supposedly a joke. Whereas the Anthropic cosmological principle brings in one place hundreds, literally hundreds, of arguments that says that man's place is a very privileged place in the universe. And in fact, that the probability of life existing is so remote as to be inconceivably small. Let me bring a few items out here. This has nothing to do with the talk. I'll get to the talk in a few minutes, but this is so good. For example, in order for a universe to support life, it must be on the order of 10 billion years old. It must be on the order of 10 billion years old. Because in order to get life forms, you have to have the products like carbon and nitrogen and so forth, which require the basic process of the main star sequence, forming a star, decaying, dying, and so forth and so on, in order to get that crucible to form these products that are necessary for life, and that takes on the order of 10 to the 10 years. On the order of 10 billion years. So in order to even have the materials around, to have the materials around for life, you have to have about 10 billion years going for you. And since the size of the universe and the age of the universe are inextricably intertwined, the fact that the universe is large is a mere consequence of the fact that it had to be old. It had to be about 10 billion years old in order to have the materials around in order to have life. That's one of the other. Then there's a whole other, these are all chapters in this book, like 100-page chapters with about thousands of references and so forth and so on. There's a special role of carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen in life. Once in a while, I'm a layman. I'm not a biologist. I'm a mathematician, physicist, whatever you want to call, theologian, whatever you want to call me, but I'm not a biologist in any case. I've heard these stories. Well, if we didn't have carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, we could. If we didn't have an oxidized atmosphere, we could perhaps have. Why not use liquid ammonia and have life forming in liquid ammonia? That's actually another subsidiary point. He argues that there's such a special role for carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, which is so critically dependent on some very important physical parameters, that if things were just slightly different, it is inconceivable that anything approaching life could even occur.
That's another point.
You gotta read the whole book. The one about the liquid ammonia, let me just give you a quote here, just a second here. Page 552. The basic problem with ammonia is that ammonia ice doesn't float. And the range for which it remains liquid is a very critical range. It's not really a large range from the viewpoint of the variations in temperature that you would normally expect to occur on a planet of any decent size. In fact, the variations in temperature across our own planet Earth would completely destabilize the idea of a liquid ammonium ocean, so to speak. And because of the fact it tends to freeze and then sink, what would happen is, see, what happens with ice, let's put it in context. What happens with ice is when ice freezes, it floats. And when it it covers the surface of the oceans and performs, actually, there's an insulation kind of, that kind of prevents that process from continuing ad infinitum. But if you have a product that freezes and then sinks, it freezes, it goes down to the bottom, and then it sits there. And now it's insulated from melting, at least at the normal rate, because of all the intervening material. More freezes and sinks. So if you have very much variation in temperature, then over the course of eons or long periods of time, you'd basically have a frozen ocean. You wouldn't have anything that would be liquid ammonia. That's one of the arguments there. Oh, that's just a couple of them. Third point is, let me just read a quote. This is kind of cute. You might consider it slightly sacrilegious. I don't consider it sacrilegious. This is by Paul Ehrlich. God created two acts to follow. First, he created the universe in a big bang. Second, he was negligent enough to leave behind evidence of this act. That introduces the experiment of Penzias and Wilson, is that Penzias? Feltheff and laboratory people who were trying to clean out their instruments in 1965 or thereabouts, and they were trying to measure some of the radiation coming to them from the various parts of the universe. And they had this annoying interference that they couldn't get rid of. And they just, no matter what they did, they couldn't get rid of it. They tore the machine apart, put it back together again. They found a bird nest in their antenna. They removed that, cleaned it all out, Couldn't get rid of it. Discovered that actually this was 3 degrees Kelvin, residual radiation from the universe. And that was actually the thing that kind of, as far as we know today, kind of nailed the lid on the coffin of other cosmology theories and kind of proved the Big Bang theory. I'm kind of, populist in my discussion here. But anyway, that was what Paul Ehrlich was referring to as leaving the effects of his creation for people to pick up on and speculate upon. One consequence of the Big Bang theory is that the first 3 minutes of the universe are very critical. You might say, well, if we have a universe that's 15 billion years old, what in the world does the first 3 minutes matter? As a matter of fact, the first microseconds of the universe are very critical, too. As a matter of fact, according to the theories that seem to be current nowadays, most of the hydrogen and helium in the universe was created in the first 3 minutes. And that went downhill from there. So, and if hydrogen didn't have, it's a very peculiar physical characteristics, and if the situation happened, if the boundary value problems, the things that happened in the first 3 minutes of the universe have been slightly different from the way they are, by most understandings of the matter, life would have been impossible. There would have been no possibility of life. The probability of life being anywhere, there's some very juicy quotes here. He himself is an evolutionist, but I missed that particular quote. Anyway, the probability of life being anywhere is negligible. I'll get to that actually in a few minutes. So that's about all I wanted to say about the anthropic cosmological principle, but it's a whole book filled with this sort of stuff. And actually, it is not written as, there are science books and there are science books. I get kind of tired of reading the popularist type of science book, probably the kind I would write, but I get kind of tired of reading them because, you know, they get this wow position, and then they expand on this wow position, and this, you know, expand on it, expand on it, and pretty soon you don't know what's fiction and what's fact anymore because they keep extrapolating on this position. And this book is not like that. I think this book is actually very carefully written. They say it took many years to write, and I believe it. I really, truly believe it, because it is very carefully written. It's written from the viewpoint of a person who is not a mathematician, can understand it very well, although there's a lot of mathematics in it. It's a highly mathematical document. But I think that it's something that you should get. But that's all I'm going to say about the anthropic cosmological principles. But I hope I whetted your appetite so that you'll go to B. Dalton. And you know, help my stock in B. Dalton to go up a little bit. I have no stock in B. Dalton. One of the points that is made in this book is the case against intelligence. The case against intelligence. And since we are talking about the evolution of the human mind, that might be an interesting subject to look into. The bottom line is, let me just read the bottom line, then we'll get some of the above reasons. For the above reasons, and many others which we omit for reasons of space, there has developed a general consensus among evolutionists that the evolution of intelligent life, comparable in information processing ability to that of Homo sapiens, is so improbable that it is unlikely to occur on any other planet in the entire visible universe. That would be a typical conclusion. Because, and the reason he gives, is because evolving intelligent beings is such a retrograde thing to do. It is, you know, in the first place, the brain or the nervous system is so energy consuming and, you know, so delicate that, you know, to evolve these, and you got to, to evolve these things takes so much effort. To evolve a brain, and then the question is, to what end do you evolve the brain? I ask that because in order to use your intelligence, you have to have so many other things happening first. You have to have, let me just read, these are all, I have quotes for all these things, so if you want to pinhold me later on. A sophisticated nervous system requires a huge number of support systems, such as eyes, manipulative organs for transport, in order to be effective. So when you have this poor organism at first developing intelligence, you know, he has this albatross hanging on him, this nervous system that is messing up his reproductive capability. It takes longer to develop to develop the nervous system when you're during birth and the maturation process. It's just a plain liability until you have a whole lot of other things going for you. One quote here says, there's no a priori advantage to intelligence, but there's a clear reproductive hazard to intelligence. So, one of the interesting things about the human mind evolved is the point of view that from the aspect of evolution, intelligence is actually an untoward event, developing intelligence. I'll tell you just the way the biologists, some biologists talk about it. It was interesting that John Bloom mentioned convergent evolution last night, because that specifically is brought here by Ernst Mayr as an argument against the likelihood of intelligence arising anywhere in the universe. What he said was, if you look at the evolutionary scheme of things, you see that the eye, it was independently developed over 40 times in the course of evolution. And I have a reference for this, so you can look it up for yourself if you like. Whereas intelligent life was only developed, any degree of intelligence was only developed, a few times, very few times, in the course of evolution. And human intelligence was only developed once. So he says that's a good illustration of the penalty for developing intelligence. It does not, from the viewpoint of natural selection, it doesn't really pay to develop intelligence. Anyway, there you go. The So that was some stuff brought out of this book about the anthropic cosmological principle. I guess we can come back to the notes now, and we'll start from the top and see how far we get. I do have a clock here, so I guess I can try to just go until we finish up and then stop. The first page, I just have some definitions on my notes. One of the quotes is from a book on artificial intelligence. See, one of my interests in this whole subject is that I'm kind of heavily involved in artificial intelligence. But, well, let's put it this way. Artificial intelligence means all things to all people. Depending on whom you ask, you'll get 100 different definitions of what artificial intelligence is. I'll give you my definition later on. Then it brings up all kinds of witchcraft questions like, can we develop artificial intelligence? Can we duplicate the operations of the brain? So forth and so on. In fact, that one of the things I hope we can do today is talk about the development of the appreciation or the study of artificial intelligence since computers were invented about 40 years ago. And look at some of the conclusions that people are coming to now in that area, although these conclusions are always subject to change. And I've been reading some books that have been changing some of the conclusions. But anyway, the quote at the top of the notes is from one book, a recent book on artificial intelligence, kind of a textbook. It says, learning begins with organized knowledge. It grows and becomes better organized. Without strong clues as to what is to be learned, nothing gets learned. Sort of expressing kind of a frustration of people working in the area of artificial intelligence that says, you've got to have something to hang your hat on or you can't get anywhere. Now, from the viewpoint of evolution, that's a real problem because how do you get started? You know, once you're started, like Dr. Newman was talking last night about, we just get this random protein sequence, and then what you do is you use differential activity. You build something, and then instead of building another one all over again, you just make little changes here. And as Dr. Newman pointed out, the basic problem there is you already have given yourself a reproductive system. And that itself is a big question, big issue, okay? So, how can you build an intelligent system without having some intelligence to start with? That is kind of the bottom line question that you have to ask yourself. In fact, that is the gut issue, which I mentioned at the bottom of the page. Can the things that the mind does be plausibly understood as the end result of an evolutionary development driven solely by laws of random activity apart from design? Now, if you grant design, then you don't have any problems because that is the underlying intelligence that directs activity. But the question really is, can you get where you are now without design? That is the bottom line question. And that is why books like this Anthropic Cosmological Principle are so interesting. These people, of course, at least don't visibly, in fact, I think they kind of specifically deny the idea of a plan or a design. They use plan with a capital P. They deny the idea of a plan. But on the other hand, they argue against the high improbability of what they're describing. So you have to somehow deal with that. One of the consequences that that quote at the top of the page was in a summary of a number of branches of research in artificial intelligence which were basically trying to bootstrap from nothing, to develop some significant intelligence. Let me, keep getting these sidetracks, but that's a character, I'm sorry, that's a characteristic of my teaching. I always get the sidetracks. The sidetracks are usually more interesting than the talk, I hope. For those of you who are not really into probability and statistics, there was an interesting change in the outlook of physics around 1900. Prior to 1900, prior to 1900, the basic idea was there were these sort of eternal physics laws, and then things kind of devolved from these eternal physics laws. You have the law of gravity, and therefore, Earth going around the sun, and you have properties of the Earth going around the sun which are derived from these gravitational laws. And so, during the 1700s, 1800s, these natural consequences of these God-given or nature-given or something fundamental laws were being developed until we started getting constitutions and problems. one of the most curious problems was this thing called the second law of thermodynamics, which didn't fit in these natural laws. It was kind of sort of sitting over there. He kind of believed it, but it was kind of sitting over there, and there wasn't any real basis for it. You know, he couldn't derive it from the fundamental laws, and it implied a directionality to the time, which didn't seem to, you know, the fundamental laws of nature are fundamentally non-directional in time. As far as the motion, the laws of physics, you can go forward and backward in time with great abandon, no problem. The second law of thermodynamics was a contradiction to that. I mean, they said that there's a sort of a one direction of time, that things get messier. The further you go, things get messier. That's basically the idea of thermodynamics. But around 1900, so this law was sitting around there. People didn't really know what to do with it. It was kind of embarrassing to have this messy law sitting there with all these other things that are so nicely based on a few principles, Newton's laws, and so forth and so on. And then the concept developed that, maybe if we assume, instead of determinism, if we assume random properties, randomness, maybe the randomness itself will lead to laws. Well, that sounds like a contradiction, but that's not a contradiction. And that, in fact, was the development of the early three or four decades of the 1900s, culminating, there was some work going on before 1900, but it was really formalized and made really proper, and, so mathematicians wouldn't be embarrassed to talk about it, things like that, in the 1930s, primarily, mostly by Russians, Kolmogorov and others, who formalized the concept of probability and statistics, Shannon in the United States, the concepts of probability and statistics, in which assuming random things happening or chance things happening, if you precisely describe the chance events that are occurring and you look at them happening and you let them happen millions and millions and millions of times, pretty soon you see regular shape theory, like the normal law, the law of large numbers, the Gaussian distribution of noise about a mean, and the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics now in any proper physics school would be derived, of course, in statistical mechanics or something like that. It would be a statistical property. As a matter of fact, Einstein, I believe it was, in 1905, he produced more than just one. He did, it was more than just special relativity. I may be off by a year or two in the date, but I think around that time he also produced his own distribution for gases, his explanation of Brownian motion and special relativity. I'm really talking off the top of my head. This is about 30 years ago I studied this. So I think that all that happened right around 1905. Einstein produced all those papers, one explaining Brownian motion. In fact, there's one distribution of random motion of gases that has his name to it, or is associated with his name. He put in a special theory of relativity, and the third one, which I just forgot already, I have a long memory span. Anyway, but the basic idea was, assuming randomness instead of determinism, you come up with laws. Well, that really excited people, because they thought, maybe it's possible. Just by assuming randomness, we can come up with all this apparent order we have in the universe. That's sort of where we're coming at from with the idea of evolution. And that was sort of the starting point of a lot of artificial intelligence work. Artificial intelligence started with this idea, maybe we can have machines kind of bootstrap themselves up and become learning machines by just empirically observing what's going on around them and forming rules based on experience and come up with something. And the bottom line was that what that quote said at the top of the page, unfortunately, it hasn't worked so hot. Unless you really know what to learn, you can't learn very much. That's basically the idea. Now, there's a few definitions there also, which we will get to in a little later if we're blessed with enough time. And the curious thing about these definitions of intelligence, reason, wisdom, the point of view that I want you to think about as you're looking at these definitions, I'm not going to particularly go over them, is whether these definitions are practical definitions or theoretical definitions. Now, this is interesting from one particular point of view. If you look at the concept of wisdom, as it is developed in academia, or actually as a strand of development of the concept of intelligence, of intellectual activity, of what I would call the Western strand, which you might have say was kind of formalized in the Greek schools by Aristotle, Plato, and company, and developed through the Scholastic Age and on to the present. That stream of thought has the idea of wisdom as being some kind of intellectual activity, you know, a sort of a divorce from any practical application. Your wisdom is wisdom, capital W. And the interesting thing is that that concept of wisdom contrasts with what you should know of as the Hebrew or Judaic strand of wisdom, where wisdom, with a capital W, is above all practical, above all it works. Okay, that is the, and there's a fundamental difference there between wisdom, by wisdom meaning something that works, or by wisdom meaning something that is abstract, theoretical, in some fundamental sense. And I'm going to argue later on, if you have to get there, that one of the fundamental problems that the intellectual community has today is that we're still carrying along the baggage of that strand of Western thought that came through Greece, scholasticism, and so forth, that says that wisdom really is intellectual activity, kind of separate from the question of whether it works or not. You might say, well, I don't know if you thought it was talking. Okay, but the interesting thing is, look at these definitions here. At least as I graded them, in those three or four definitions there, I see, I counted four evidences where the definition was tied to practical application, and two where it was truly academic. For example, intelligence. The ability to learn or understand or deal with new and trying situations. That's practical, okay? The ability to deal with new and trying situations, or secondly, the ability to apply knowledge to manipulate one's environment. Okay, the definition of intelligence. Now, you won't find that in your SATs, because the SAT notion of intelligence is something that's purely academic. I mean, you may ace your SATs and not be able to open the door, because one's practical and one's theoretical. I have a particular bug about SATs. Because we have a daughter, I shouldn't probably mention this in tape. Maybe I won't. I'll say there's somebody has a daughter who is very bright in her way, but she can't do anything in the SAT. And I know she can't do anything. In fact, if she can get 400 on the SAT, she's going great. Why is that? Well, for complicated reasons. But nonetheless, she is going to have the world by its tail. It's sometime later on in life, because the Lord willing, and so forth and so on. I mean, that's what the Lord wants. Because her concept of wisdom is eminently practical. Eminently practical. Okay, look at the definition of reason. Now, here's an interesting split here between the British and the Americans here. Oxford. Reason, the intellectual power or faculty, which is ordinarily employed in adapting thought or action to some end. That's a practical definition, if I ever saw one. Look at the Webster one. The power of comprehending, inferring, or thinking, especially in orderly, rational ways. That's academic. Okay? So, I'm going through this exercise because I think it's very interesting to sort of stand back and say, where are we? What do we think of as intelligent activity? What is intelligence? I mean, if we're going to be talking about evolution of intelligence, at least let's understand what it is. Let's have some notion of what it is. Wisdom. Oxford. The capacity of judging rightly in matters relating to life and conduct. Soundness of judgment in the choice of means and ends. That sounds practical to me. Look at the Webster. Accumulated philosophic and scientific learning, the ability to discern inner qualities in relationships. That's about the most academic definition of wisdom I've ever heard. You see the difference there? I mean, we're not talking about some arbitrary quibble. I don't care. We're talking about what is your outlook on life? How do you view intelligence? What is intelligence? Is intelligence something that is some academic enterprise, a philosophical system, or is intelligence something that works? And I thought it was interesting, even in the definitions of the words in the dictionary, to see this sort of bifurcation, dichotomy of definition. Well, that gets on to the subject at hand. How does the mind work? And from here on in, I am more or less following one of the papers that I wrote. So if we don't get done today, you can look at that paper and throw barbs at it or whatever you want to do. I'd like to have a little time for questions later on. And incidentally, that paper is not necessarily pristine here either, because it, the trouble is, you know, one of the problems with amateur practitioners in areas like this is we have so many things we want to say. We usually say 90% of them halfway, which leaves only 45% comprehension. Anyway, the mind at work. What does the mind do? And the interesting question here is, what I suggest you're doing here is actually, you know, sit back and think of yourself. Think of yourself. What does my mind do? And I suggested three thought experiments you might have. Incidentally, the subject of thought experiments is another interesting thing. There's so many sidetracks in this business. You know, the way theoretical physicists work and the way applied physicists and biology, almost everybody else in the world, are two entirely different things. So a theoretical physicist, a thought experiment, is a really respectable thing. What you do is you just sit down, you get away from the laboratory, you don't need the laboratory. You just sort of sit down and say, how does this work out? And how could I show that it works or doesn't work? And one of the most interesting thought experiments is the Schrodinger cat experiment, which is a thought experiment, which I won't go into. If you want to find out about it, look up your dictionary Schrodinger, and then look up cats. Maybe if you have a really good dictionary, you might find out what it's talking about. Another thought experiment was the proof by Galileo that the acceleration of gravity is constant. That's good enough, I think I'll tell. You know, Aristotle was not one who liked to dabble in experiments too much. He liked thought experiments. And in fact, perhaps that was one of the problems with the early scholastic line of development. They didn't like to get their hands dirty too well. Actually, it's not really true, because there were some early Greek philosophers who really did get their hands dirty. But somehow that was in sort of one bucket, and then the theoretical stuff was in another bucket, and they didn't really mix too well. But when Aristotle was writing his book, Physics, he wrote down the laws of motion and all that sort of stuff, and he did it without any experiments, as far as anybody could figure out. And he concluded that heavier bodies will accelerate faster than lighter bodies. You know, they'll just, you know, if you drop a heavy body and a light body, the heavy body would be attracted to the Earth faster than the light body. And, you know, it's natural, it's a natural thing to think. And Galileo, whom we all know as the great empirical scientist, said in his book, The Two Sciences, he says, no, it's not true. And here's my experiment. You take two bodies, one's heavy and one's light. And suppose you say the heavier body falls faster than the lighter body, okay? Tie them together. Now you have a body that, you know, because the lighter body falls slower than the heavier body, the lighter body, when they're tied together, will retard the motion of the heavier body. So therefore, the combined mass will actually fall slower than the heavy body alone. On the other hand, the heavy body is, you know, wants to go faster than the lighter body, so it'll kind of speed up. So you'll get up with a velocity in between that of the lighter body and the heavier body, but the combination is heavier still, contradiction. Therefore, the acceleration of gravity is constant. What do you need a laboratory for? What do you need the Tower of Pisa for, you know? Okay, so... Okay, there. That's an example of a thought experiment, but we're going to do some thought experiments. Visual recall. One of the interesting ways to find out how the mind works is just look at the question of visual recall. Suppose, you know, what do I mean by visual recall? There's two kinds of visual recall. One would be unexpected recall, one's expected recall. If you know somebody's going to quiz you on something, you'll make sure you learn about it, okay? But if you don't know that somebody's going to quiz you on something, what do you do? And when it comes with visual recall, it's a particularly touchy issue. Because from the viewpoint of computer scientists, at least, images, image processing, visual things are extremely profligate as far as the amount of information you have to store in order to be able to process visual images. One time, you know, a couple of years ago, one of the projects I was working on, we were talking about doing ocean surveillance over the Pacific Ocean or over a large ocean body and passing the information back to a station. And a simple question would be, well, you know, how many bits of information do you have to have an adequate description of the surface of the ocean over a picture, you know, whatever a given satellite can see? And the answer is a minimum of, the data rate has to be a minimum of like 10,000 bits per second. I mean, that even assumes intelligent processing, because, I mean, if you just literally copied every bit of it, you know, everything you see, I mean, you know, a bit is sort of a dark or light span, let's say black or white. So if you look at a newspaper picture, look at it very closely, you'll see little dark and white spots, light intensity spots. If you think of each of those as a bit, you ask yourself, count how many bits are in a typical newspaper picture, and you'll very quickly get, I don't know what the number is, but you'll very quickly get to 10,000 anyway, I'm pretty sure. But anyway, the idea was an intelligent camera taking a picture, a snapshot of the ocean, and then transmitting that back to Earth, and then it's moving a satellite, it's moving around, it keeps taking pictures. You've got to have a minimum data rate of like 10,000 bits per second. Very profligate. I mean, you know, doing anything visually just takes all kinds of processing. And so now, you know, you take that in mind and you go back to the question of how does the mind do visual recall? For example, you know, I hope that you haven't been thinking about this, but I'm trying to give you one of the unexpected results. Think about where you parked the car yesterday. You know, how far away were you from the post? Was there a post nearby? How far were you from the post? What was separating you from the sidewalk? How many cars were around where you were parked? Were there puddles around? Where were the puddles? Was it dark? Was it light? What kind of a building was it you were parked against? Is it a stucco building? Was it a clapboard? Was it, of course, everything around here is cedar. That's not a fair question. No, it's not cedar. You know, those would be examples. And if somebody asked you and quizzed you, or even better yet, you had an accident, and then somebody asked you questions about what happened to the accident, you know, those are what you call unexpected recall, where your mind is asked to conjure up from its past record of what happened, a description of what happened, and that is where the rubber meets the road. I mean, now we're talking about practical intelligence, because if you take a camera can take snapshots all over the place and just store them away, and you know, but if you think about it for a minute, the mind's problem is two or threefold. Well, first question is just plain storing all those images, okay? And second place, the transmission of the images from the eye to wherever it's going to be stored. And remember, we said for satellite processing, you've got to have a minimum of 10,000 bits per second. The practical constraints in visual recall are overwhelming. And if you think about, you know, if you had a computer scientist sort of ask you, well, how does, you know, I want to copy the brain, and what I'd like to do is I'd like to have my brain, my artificial brain, set up so I can do unexpected recall. Or as I can see, the only recourse that you have would be to have literal visual images of all your three. Maybe have an exponential decay function so that, those of you who don't know what exponential decay is, that's all right. Just gradually fades out in the distance, okay? So maybe, you know, here's time now, and 10 minutes ago, I have a little less impression of what happened. An hour ago, a little less, and so forth. And gradually, it fades out, you know, over the horizon. But nonetheless, if I ask now my artificial brain, what happened yesterday afternoon? Where did you park your car? How much mud was on your tires? Or whatever you want to ask, you know, even though I hadn't expected, you just to have to go back and retrieve that picture and then look at the picture and say, well, there's 3,423 bricks in that wall. You know, whatever, you know, it would have everything. But it's easy to see from the mind's viewpoint that is an incredible burden, an undoable burden on the mind. Because, now here's an interesting point. I disagree with this book on that one point. It talks about the capacity of the mind and talks about the possibility of artificial intelligence and so forth. And they sort of give an upcheck and they say, yeah, a Cray computer is now within a factor of 10 of having not storage needs to duplicate the brain and so forth and so on. Well, you know, just look at the communication problem. Now, you know, one of the references I have in the back, this is one reason why I like talking to a group like this, because then you can correct all my mistakes. You look at Utah, William R. Utah, the last reference there, three or four volumes there on sensory coding, and basically what he's talking about is how we get information from the eyes to wherever it's going to be stored and how we get it back and so forth and so on. And one of the things that interested me as a computer scientist is the question of the data rates going from point A to point B. And the bottom line is, if I can get my notes here, I may not be able to get my notes, but I might have to just tell you this. I'm on page 4 of my notes here. Yeah, the maximum data rate over the neural system appears to be something in the order of 1,000 bits per second. From what I can gather, this is an aggregate figure. The optic nerve has in the order of 1,000,000 individual fibers, but a fiber has a maximum data rate on the order of 25 bits per second, which is a number based on physical and chemical limitations of the cell. Brain waves, which I assume relate somehow to individual cell reactions, are measured in electroencephalograms at frequencies up to about 50 hertz. From communications theory, this would tend to confirm a data rate of about 25 bits per second. Clearly, these data rates do not support much literal processing of visual images. If we compare what happens with this satellite photograph, meaning 10,000 bits per second, and then we look at the mechanics that the eye has to go through to do any communication to the brain, you see very quickly that we cannot support very much communication of very detailed information. Now, I think this book, The Anthropic Cosmological Principle, kind of gets off on a false track, because he doesn't talk about the communication pads at all. He talks simply about the storage capacity. He says that the brain has the capacity to store 10 to the 10 to 10 to 15 bits of information, and the firing rate of the brain is an average of 1 to 5% of the cells in the brain, blah, 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 blah. So he's talking about huge data rates. But I think a more proper thing is, there's two issues. There's the capacity, and then there's the communication. And those are the bugaboos of any computer, okay? It's not just a question of what your storage capacity is. It's a question of how I'm going to get from there to here. Because I have to process over here, and I'm going to store over here. And I'm not processing where I'm storing. You know, I've got to go from one point to the other. The eye processes something, and then it passes it to the place where the brain, wherever the recall comes from, it passes it there, and somehow I've got to get from here to there. So the communication lines, the wires, become a limiting feature in any kind of decent computer. And he doesn't talk about that at all. So he talks about the huge storage capacity and the firing rate. But on the other hand, I think that I'd like to see a decent analysis of this, and maybe somebody has done it, and maybe they can correct my numbers. But at least the numbers I have available tell me that the communication rate from the eye to the brain is far less than necessary for anything approaching literal visual transmission. So the question comes up, well, here's a brain, and it's trying to do its best to be intelligent here, but it's got some severe practical constraints. The practical constraints are in the lines of how much capacity can it transmit over its neural network. How can it handle it? And here's my answer, how it works. The way the brain works, according to a lot of artificial intelligence, so if it's wrong, explain that. The way the brain works is not by doing literal copying of pictures. Definitely not. If it did, that would make it easy to do visual recall of an unexpected object. But what it does is it takes some very selective sampling of what it sees, of its environment that it sees about it, and it relates those samplings with what is called a frame, or a frame of reference, or whatever you want to call it, a frame, a model, whatever you want to call it, of what it would expect to see. So that, you know, when you parked your car yesterday, you were in the context of a frame, the differences between what I'm seeing and the frame. Another way you can see that's really the way you work is look at what happens when you are disoriented momentarily. One of the things a frame does is provide you an orientation of where you are. know, that dark shadow over there is not a moon crater.
Okay,
I don't care what you say, it's not a moon crater because I'm not on the moon. That's all of a sudden kind of orientation. And the way you can see what happens when you're disoriented, with orientation is occasionally we're all disoriented. You know, you ever get up in the morning and you don't know where you are, or something happened, and maybe it just happens to me, but it does happen occasionally. You get disoriented and you sort of lose where you are. Once in a while, you know, you go down a step and you miss a step or something like that, and momentarily, you weren't even thinking about going down the steps, but all of a sudden, you know, you're stumbling all over the place because you lost your orientation. I think those moments of disorientation sort of help to show you how important orientation is in visual recall or visual processing. So, and I believe the things like the frames, the orientation, are things that the mind has contrived to get over some real physical limitations in the communications process, the processing of data. Now, incidentally, the use of frames to fill in, you just had to take a few pieces of data, and then you use the general frames to fill in the picture. That concept, if that is true, it gives you a notion of why it is you can really make mistakes in recalling past experiences. If you're recalling a distant past experience, you may have difficulty distinguishing between the frame and the data that you're measuring, and you may read things into your picture that aren't really there. I think that's why I'm always very sympathetic to people who describe what happened on August 8, 1985, because that's also another joke. But not a joke, it's supposed to mean something to some people. Because your frame of reference your recall is filled with a few data points, perhaps, which are perhaps fading in time, plus a lot of these frames. And you get to the point where you can't really distinguish what's the frame and what's the data point. I once in a while recall some things from my childhood, and I tell you now, I can't tell whether those are because people told me they were that way or whether that's because that's what I really saw. For example, I remember when I was about age 4, walking down the street in a hot summer day, playing in some pitch and getting some pitch all over my pants. They had these little pitch with bubbles, that was fun to play with. And I that's just a little cameo in my past, and I don't know whether I really remember that or whether it's just because it was very much impressed with me when I got home. So that's visual recall. And to me, that thought experiment, which I would encourage you to kind of do yourself. That kind of experiment, which I think should help to form your mind on what I mean by intelligence. Second experiment, I won't be able to get through all these, is visual recognition. The question now is not so much as recall, or unexpected recall, let's say, but the question of how do I know this is a cat? How do I know that's a chair? Well, those of you who have labored through Plato's cave dialogues, are well aware of the question, the deep questions behind what is a chair, because Plato's concept, if I may master his philosophy, his concept was that there is some ideal chair sitting up here, which is I believe Socrates kind of figured it was built into your brain, it was there already before you were born. There's an ideal chair there, and what we see is a realization of a chair over there, and we compare it to our ideal, and that's how we know it's a chair. Well, that has two consequences. Number one is it does imply there's something there before. But the second problem is that any actual observation is a corruption of the real thing. And that corruption issue is a whole other subject, which we'll get to, which we won't get to probably. Anyway, there's a very kind of acute modern-day illustration of this thing in the subject of called the perceptron. This is A.K. Dudney is a person who writes for the Scientific American. I write a column just about every month, and I enjoy reading him. And he was trying to explain some of the difficulties of visual processing by computers. He says, imagine a black box, rather like a camera. At the front is a lens, and on one side is a dial with various settings, such as tree, house, cat, and so on. With the dial set to cat, we go for a walk. and presently encounter a cat sitting on the neighbor's porch. When the box is aimed at the cat, a red light goes on. When the box is aimed at anything else, the light remains dark. Inside the box is a digital retina, sending impulses to a logical network. This is an instance of a device called a perceptron. At one time, it was hoped that perceptrons would ultimately be capable of real-world recognition tasks like this one described in the fantasy, but something went wrong. But what's wrong is, visual recognition is a vastly more complicated thing than anybody yet can really grasp. And so this concept of this perceptron, which is able to pick out a cat, or pick out a dog, or pick out a... You know, the thing is, look at the problem that it has. It's got to pick out a cat, not in an ideal laboratory circumstance, okay? But it has to pick out a cat with, you know, when it's a cloudy day, when it's partially obscured by a tree trunk, when there are all kinds of, you know, it's shadows, it's dust. It's got to pick out cats that are black, white, motley of various sorts, mangy cats, healthy cats, big cats, small cats. It's got to know this is a cat. And the question is, how do you train? What is this perceptron going to look like that is going to pick out this cat? And what that is intended to illustrate is how truly marvelous the visual recognition process is. Another example is the idea of automatic reading of characters. And Doug Hofstadter, who wrote a book called Metamatical Themas, was talking about that and observing that any given letter of the English, just restrict ourselves to the English alphabet, any given letter comes in probably thousands of official forms and probably millions of unofficial forms by the time you take various people's scrawls. And somehow, you know, you're supposed to be able to say, that's an A, or that's a B. Actually, the plain fact is, I think in my own experience, I don't usually look for an A or a B, I look for words. And if something looks like it starts with something closely resembling an A and ends with something closely resembling a T and is about five words long, I try for about, or some such thing, at least in my own writing. We got a grade card from a teacher about a week ago, and on the bottom were about three lines of text. And as far as I was concerned, they could have taken a protractor with that drawn lines like this. And I couldn't read it for... do you really know what I was talking about? Naomi's notes? I couldn't figure out what that said at all. I mean, it was just one, you know, just... And it was supposedly words. I could barely tell where the words began and ended. Anyway, that's the problem of perception. Incidentally, it's a perfectly fair game to talk about the places where the eye fails at perception. Because when you talk about where the eye fails, that gives you a better appreciation of what it takes to succeed, and what the eye does when it succeeds. In fact, you know, I think one of the most marvelous ways of looking at intelligence as a whole is looking at its failures, looking at the people who are marginal IQ or below IQ, and seeing what they do differently and how different they are. So I think the fact that the mind sometimes fails is itself a very useful thing. Finally, I wanted to talk about speech and communication. I'm not going to talk about that. Anyway, that's the third experiment you're going to have to look at in my paper if you're interested. Anyway, the summary of these experiments about the mind, the purpose of these experiments is simply to ask ourselves, well, when we talk about intelligence, what are we really dealing with? And what you observe is that the mind's activity is strongly affected by physical constraints. Incidentally, that reminds me of a snide comment made by Stephen Jay Gould, who's not one of the most evangelical theologians around. He's evangelical, but not in the way we'd be interested in. Stephen Jay Gould made a comment. He wrote a whole book on what a lousy engineer God was if God actually created the world. And one of his comments was about the eye. And he says, you know, no self-expecting engineer has ever invented the eye. I mean, you know, it doesn't focus right. You know, it's a blurry image. You know, I mean, all the negatives. And you know, I'm just thinking, you know, from a viewpoint of a person who is steeped in modern technology, that probably makes sense. But the trouble is, modern technology wouldn't work where the brain doesn't work. It's not precision that matters. It's workability that matters. And in that particular category, I'd like to have Stephen Jay Gould show me the plans for this self-replicating device that's going to produce this perfect eye. That would be really great. I'd love to see that. The fact is, the mind works. And it works in the face of very severe physical constraints. You might get misled by large numbers about how many brain cells we have, tens of billions or whatever it is. Don't be misled, because those numbers, those are like talking about the creation occurred 10 billion years ago. There was lots of time for evolution to occur. All you got to do is think a little bit and you realize that ain't nearly enough time. And the size of the brain isn't nearly enough for the kind of intelligence that we, in our Western notion of philosophy and what progress is and so forth, the way we would impose our intelligence on creating a brain, it'll never work. There's not enough intelligence, there's not enough there, okay? There's not enough, technically, there's not enough to do it. The brain works with physical constraints. In fact, if, as I mentioned in my paper, if you were some alien being told about life on Earth, and about what the brain does, you would surely conclude that it's impossible, because what is being described is clearly science fiction. It couldn't ever happen. That the mind would actually be able to do these things like visual recall, recognition, and so forth, because it's just not, you can look at the data, you can look at how many cells, you can look at the communication paths, you can measure the speed of communication, and information theory is information theory, and so many bits per second is so many bits per second, and there's clearly not enough there to do what you want to do. I think the answer is there is enough there. But it's there because, but what is happening is we are not doing literal translations, where the mind is putting these many layers of meaning on top of things. We got these frames and these models and so forth. All right, and finally, I talked on the bottom page too about the role of logical deduction in my comment there, and it's not very strong. The mind, in science and analysis, logical deduction is the central part of science and analysis and progress in science. But I think as far as the human mind is concerned, as far as its functioning, its roles go, logical deduction plays a decidedly secondary role. And some people, you think it doesn't play any role at all. But I think that's probably an overstatement. It probably does have some role for most people that I've met. Okay, finally, we're getting actually very close to the end. I don't really want to go very much further in my talk because I've talked a little bit about the Greek versus Hebrew concept of wisdom. I wanted to leave a little time for questions because I assume 10:30 is kind of a drop dead date, and I'd rather leave a little time for questions. But anyway, the meaning of intelligence: the mind is a prototype for learning. You ought to read that in the book in the write-up if you like. The basic conflict between the Greek and the Hebrew concept of wisdom. The Hebrew concept of wisdom is skill and ability. A very interesting way of looking at that. Look at Proverbs chapter 8. Proverbs chapter 8 is a chapter of a bit of poetry about personified wisdom at the side of God in the creation of the world. And what you discover when you read through Proverbs chapter 8 is, above all, the thing that is really being praised about wisdom is it works. It produces a workable world. Now, to a Greek, from the Greek line of thought, that would be sort of an irrelevant comment. we'll have our mathematics, and whether it works, who cares if it works or not? In fact, G.A. Carty, who was one of the British mathematicians around the early part of this century, he prided himself on having useless mathematics. That was the epitome of mathematics. To have something. In fact, he was devastated when he discovered that one of his theorems is actually useful. That's about the difference for you. It takes a little getting used to. But anyway, there's a real dichotomy there between the Greek and Hebrew. You form your own mind of that by looking things up. Developing the Western concept of wisdom. In the paper, I go through kind of a sequence of how we sort of bootstrapped ourselves up to where we are today. Starting off with the idea of objective facts existing external to the mind. The mind sort of naturally thinks of itself as the center of the universe. But one of the outstanding features of geometry, as developed by the Egyptian geometers and then codified by Euclid and others, one of the outstanding features is that there are these laws of geometry that we can talk about external from the mind, and then logically you can deduce things from these. This is kind of a truth that exists objectively, you know, apart from the working of the mind or the universe or anything. It's just truth, okay? And the idea of developing academic subjects by codifying things that occur external to the mind, objective facts, and making logical deductions, that must have been a real breakthrough when that concept was developed, and I assume it was developed somewhere around, you know, first millennium B.C. Don't know. I mean, perhaps people were analytic before that. I guess the Egyptians probably were. But anyway, the second item, one of the things that stymied people, at least in the Western world, in the Greek world, in the vicinity of 500 B.C. through, you know, 1200 or 1300 A.D., was the fact that I mentioned before, Plato's observation that any realization is faulty. Anything you see, anything that comes through your sensory perceptions is a faulty replication of what is true, what is the real thing. And the fact that what we are seeing, what we perceive, what we take into our brain is never the real thing, it's only a faulty replication of it, was an obstacle to progress. A very genuine obstacle to progress, because you would say, how can I ever know truth? How can I ever know what is really true if everything I measure has errors in it? And so therefore, you know, you get Aristotle, Socrates saying that, well, really the real truth is this ideal chair. The real truth is this ideal government of the city. The real truth is this. And Socrates would have the notion that God had implanted, or somebody had implanted this in our minds, and that is the real truth there, and those abstract things are the real truth, and what is out here is kind of almost irrelevant. And, you know, it's, that's just, you know, that's faulty senses. Then around the time of the Enlightenment, around the time of Newton and Galileo and Kepler and Tycho Brahe and so forth and so on, gradually developed the concept of, well, we can get around the idea of our faulty senses by talking about reproducible experiments. Maybe in any given experiment, I can't know whether I'm measuring, what I'm measuring is correct. But if millions of people independently make the same experiment and come up with the same conclusion, then statistically, or whatever you want to call it, you know, we can get around our faulty senses by posing reproducible experiments. And so that was a real advance, and of course that led to the science age. And that age of science, of course, has its own shibboleth, its own pitfalls. One of which is, and I put the time here around 1950 or thereabouts. You might, my point of view is, I think we're in a different age now, or actually we're in a transition between ages. We're not in the scientific age anymore. One of the characteristics of the scientific age was sort of on kind of absolute belief in the reproducible experiment as a way of getting at truth. And as quantum mechanics and as physicists delve deeper and deeper into the true nature of things, they began to realize more and more that you can only go so far that way. And then there came a philosopher along called Karl Popper, who says, well, really, even your idea of deductive science is wrong. You're not really learning facts by experimentation. You're learning facts by making models and then testing your models. And your models being falsifiable, you make your progress. Here's how falsifiability works. I have a model of what should happen. And then I propose a test of that model. If the test passes, I haven't learned anything. If the test fails, then I can revise my model and I have learned something. And you get the truth by starting here, testing, failing, moving over here, testing, failing, moving over here, testing, failing, moving over here, and by the process of failing to pass tests, you gradually converge on what must be the truth. You can never, see, in logic there's a asymmetry in logic. You can never prove a universal truth to be true. But you can prove a universal truth, a claimed universal truth, to be false with a single counter example. Okay? So Popper was applying that to empirical science, saying that really we don't prove theorems to be true, we prove them to be false, and then we modify our theory. And a good science versus bad science is how well you pose your falsifiable theorem, and how strictly you apply that criterion to your concept of the world. Well, anyway, I think I better stop now, and you're going to have to read the rest of the book in the paper. I hope I at least started off by talking a little bit about intelligence, hoping to clarify your minds a little bit about what you mean by intelligence. I began by saying that from an evolutionary point of view, intelligence is almost an embarrassment, at least from what I can gather. And so is the mind evolved? I would say that even the biologists would say the probability is very low. And from my point of view, I'd say I don't think so.